Ang, you should pray the gods don't strike you with lightning for speaking like that.
Luca groaned, rolling his eyes, but Emrys continued his lecture, gesturing at the youth with his teacup.
Those powers were gifts given to us by them long ago, gifts we needed to survive and were passed down through the generations. Of course they'd be aligned with the elements, and of course they'd be watered down after so long.
Selena glanced toward those iron figurines on the mantle. She contemplated mentioning that some believed the gods had also bred with ancient humans and given them magic that way. But that would involve more talking than necessary. She tilted her head to the side.
What do you know about Rowan? How old is he?
The more she learned, the better. Emrys wrapped his wrinkled hands around his teacup.
He's one of the few Fae we see around Mistward. He stops in every now and then to retrieve reports for Maeve, but he keeps to himself. Never stays the night. Occasionally he'll come with the others like him. There are six of them who closely serve the Queen as war leaders or spies, you see. They never talk to us, and all we hear are rumors about where they go and what they do. But I've known Rowan since I first came here. Not that I really know him, mind you. Sometimes he's gone for years, off serving Her Majesty. And I don't think anyone knows how old he is. When I was 15, the oldest people living here had known him since they were younglings, so I'd say he's very old.
And as mean as an adder, Luca muttered. Emrys gave him a warning look.
You'd best mind your tongue.
He glanced toward the doors, as if Rowan would be lurking there. When his gaze fell again on Selena, it was wary.
I'll admit that you're probably in for a good heap of difficulty.
He's a stone-cold killer and a sadist is what he means, Luca added. The meanest of Maeve's personal cabal of warriors, they say. Well, that wasn't a surprise either. But there were five others like him. That was an unpleasant fact. She said quietly,
I can handle him.
We're not allowed to learn the old language until we enter Doranel, Luca said. But I heard his tattoo is a list of all the people he slaughtered.
Hush, Emrys said.
It's not like he doesn't act like it. Luca frowned again at Selena. Maybe you should consider whether Doranel is worth it, you know? It's not so bad living here. She'd already had enough interacting.
I can handle him, she repeated.
Maeve couldn't intend to keep her here for years. If that started to seem likely, Selena would leave and find another way to stop the king. Luca opened his mouth, but Emrys hushed him again, his gaze falling on Selena's scarred hands.
Let her run her own course.
Luca started chattering about the weather, and Selena headed to the mountain of dishes. As she washed, she fell into a rhythm, as she'd done while cleaning her weapons aboard that ship. The kitchen sounds turned muffled as she let herself spiral down, contemplating that horrible realization again and again. She could not remember what it was like to be free.
Chapter 12. The Blackbeak clan was the last to fully assemble at the Farian Gap. As a result, they got the smallest and farthest rooms in the Warren of Halls carved into the Omega. The last of the Rune Mountains, and the northernmost of the Sister Peaks flanking the snow-blasted pass. Across the gap was the Northern Fang, the final peak of the White Fangs, which was currently occupied by the King's men, massive brutes who still didn't know quite what to make of the witches who had stalked in from every direction. They'd been here for a day, and Manon had yet to glimpse any sign of the wyverns the King had promised. She'd heard them, even though they were housed across the pass in the Northern Fang. No matter how deep you got into the Omega Stone Halls, The shrieks and roars vibrated in the stone. The air pulsed with the boom of leathery wings, and the floors hissed with the scrape of talon on rock. It had been 500 years since all three clans had assembled. There had been over 20,000 of them at one point. Now only 3,000 remained, and that was a generous estimate. All that was left of a once mighty kingdom. Still, the halls of the Omega were a dangerous place to be. Already she'd had to pull apart Asterin and a Yellowlegs bitch who hadn't yet learned that Blackbeak sentinels, especially members of the 13, didn't take lightly to being called soft-hearted. There had been blue blood splattered on their faces, and though Manon was more than pleased to see that Asterin, beautiful, brash Asterin, had done most of the damage, she'd still had to punish her second. 3 unblocked blows. 1 to the gut, so Asterin could feel her own powerlessness. 1 to the ribs, so she'd consider her actions every time she drew breath. And 1 to the face, so her broken nose would remind her that the punishment could have been far worse. Asterin had taken them all without scream or complaint or plea, just as any of the 13 would have done. And this morning, her second, nose swollen and bruised at the bridge, had given Manon a fierce grin over their miserable breakfast of boiled oats. Had it been another witch, Manon would have dragged her by the neck to the front of the room and made her regret the insolence. But Asterin... Even though Asterin was her cousin, she wasn't a friend. Manon didn't have friends. None of the witches, especially the 13, had friends. But Asterin had guarded her back for a century, and the grin was a sign that she wouldn't put a dagger in Manon's spine the next time they were knee-deep in battle. No. Asterin was just insane enough to wear the broken nose like a badge of honor, and would love her crooked nose for the rest of her not-so-immortal life. The Yellowlegs' heir, a haughty bull of a witch named Iskra, had merely given her offending sentinel a warning to keep her mouth shut and sent her down to the infirmary in the belly of the mountain. Fool. All the coven leaders were under orders to keep their sentinels in line, to suppress the fighting between clans, or else the 3 matrons would come down on them like a hammer. Without punishment, without Iskra making an example of her, the offending witch would keep at it until she got strung up by her toes by the new High Witch of the Yellowlegs clan. They'd held a sham of a memorial service last night for Baba Yellowlegs in the cavernous mess hall, lighting any old candles in lieu of the traditional black ones, wearing whatever hoods they could find, and going through the sacred words to the 3-faced goddess as though they were reading a recipe. Manon had never met Baba Yellowlegs, and didn't particularly care that she'd died. She was more interested in who had killed her, and why. They all were. And it was those questions that were exchanged between the expected words of loss and mourning. Asterin and Vesta had done the talking, as they usually did, chatting up the other witches while Manon listened from nearby. No one knew anything, though. Even her 2 shadows, concealed in the dark pockets of the mess hall as they'd been trained to do, had overheard nothing. It was the not knowing that made her shoulders tight, as Manon stalked up the sloped hallway to where the matrons and all the coven leaders were to assemble, Blackbeak and Yellowlegs witches stepping aside to let her pass. She resented not knowing anything that might be useful, that might give the 13 or the Blackbeaks an advantage. Of course, the Blue Bloods were nowhere to be seen. The reclusive witches had arrived first and claimed the uppermost rooms in the Omega, saying they needed the mountain breeze to complete their rituals every day. Religious fanatics with their noses in the wind was what Mother Blackbeak had always called them. But it had been their insane devotion to the 3-faced goddess and their vision of the Witch Kingdom under Iron Teeth rule that had mustered the clans 5 centuries ago, even if it had been the Blackbeak sentinels who'd won the battles for them. Manon treated her body as she would any other weapon. She kept it clean and honed and ready at any time to defend and destroy. But even her training couldn't keep her from being out of breath when she reached the atrium by the Black Bridge that connected the Omega to the Northern Fang. She hated the expanse of stone without even touching it. It smelled wrong. It smelled like those two prisoners she'd seen with the Duke. In fact, this whole place reeked like that. The scent wasn't natural. It didn't belong in this world. About 50 witches, the highest-ranking coven leaders in each clan, were gathered at the giant hole in the side of the mountain. Manon spotted her grandmother immediately, standing at the bridge entrance with what had to be the Blue Blood and Yellow Legs matrons. The new Yellow Legs matron was supposedly some half-sister of Baba, and she certainly looked the part. Huddled in brown robes, saffron ankles peeking out, white hair braided back to reveal a wrinkled, brutal face mottled with age. By rule, all Yellow Legs wore their iron teeth and nails on permanent display, and the new High Witches were shining in the dull morning light. Unsurprisingly, the Blue Blood matron was tall and willowy, more priestess than warrior. She wore the traditional deep blue robes, and a band of iron stars circled her brow. As Manon approached the crowd, she could see that the stars were barbed. Not surprising, either. Legend had it that all witches had been gifted by the three-faced goddess, with iron teeth and nails to keep them anchored to this world when magic threatened to pull them away. The Iron Crown, supposedly, was proof that the magic in the Blue Blood line ran so strong that their leader needed more, needed iron and pain, to keep her tethered in this realm. Nonsense, especially when magic had been gone these past 10 years. But Manon had heard rumors of the rituals the Blue Bloods did in their forests and caves. Rituals in which pain was the gateway to magic, to opening their senses. Oracles, mystics, zealots. Manon stalked through the ranks of the assembled Blackbeak coven leaders. They were the most numerous, 20 coven leaders, over which Manon ruled with her 13. Each leader touched two fingers to her brow in deference. She ignored them and took up a spot at the front of the crowd, where her grandmother gave her an acknowledging glance. An honor, for any high witch to acknowledge an individual. Manon bowed her head, pressing two fingers to her brow. Obedience, discipline, and brutality were the most beloved words in the Blackbeak clan. All else was to be extinguished without second thought. She still had her chin high, hands behind her back, when she spotted the two other heirs watching her. The Blue Blood heir, Petra, stood closest to the High Witches, her group in the center of the crowd. Manon stiffened but held her gaze. Her freckled skin was as pale as Manon's, and her braided hair was as golden as Astarin's, a deep, brassy color that caught the gray light. She was beautiful, like so many of them, but grave. Above her blue eyes, a worn leather band rested on her brow, in lieu of the Iron Star crown. There was no way of telling how old she was, but she couldn't be much older than Manon if she looked this way after magic had vanished. There was no aggression, but no smile either. Smiles were rare amongst witches, unless you were on the hunt or on a killing field. The Yellow Legs heir, though. Iskra was grinning at Manon, bristling with a challenge that Manon found herself aching to meet. Iskra hadn't forgotten the brawl between their sentinels in the hallway yesterday. If anything, from the look in Iskra's brown eyes, it seemed that the brawl had been an invitation. Manon found herself debating how much trouble she'd get into for shredding the throat of the Yellow Legs heir. It would put an end to any fights between their sentinels. It would also put an end to her life, if the attack were unprovoked. Witch justice was swift. Dominance battles could end in loss of life, but the claim had to be made up front. Without a formal provocation from Iskra, Manon's hands were tied.
"Now that we're assembled," the blue blood matron, Cressida, said, drawing Manon's attention, "shall we show you what we've been brought here to do?"
Mother Blackbeak waved a hand to the bridge, black robes billowing in the icy wind. "We walk into the sky, witches." The crossing of the Black Bridge was more harrowing than Manon wanted to admit. First, there was the miserable stone, which throbbed beneath her feet, giving off that reek that no one else seemed to notice. Then there was the screeching wind, which battered them this way and that, trying to shove them over the carved railing. They couldn't even see the floor of the gap. Mist shrouded everything below the bridge, a mist that hadn't vanished in the day they'd been here, or the days they'd hiked up the gap. It was, she supposed, some trick of the king's. Contemplating it led only to more questions, none of which she bothered to voice, or really care about all that much. By the time they reached the cavernous atrium of the Northern Fang, Manon's ears were frozen and her face was raw. She'd flown at high altitudes in all kinds of weather, but not for a long while. Not without a fresh belly of meat in her, keeping her warm. She wiped her runny nose on the shoulder of her red cloak. She'd seen the other coven leaders eyeing the crimson material, as they always did, with yearning and scorn and envy. Iskra had gazed at it the longest, sneering. It would be nice, really damn nice, to peel off the Yellowleg's heir's face one day. They reached the gaping mouth into the upper reaches of the Northern Fang. Here the stone was scarred and gouged, splattered with the triple goddess knew what. From the tang of it, it was blood. Human blood. 5 men, all looking hewn from the same scarred stone themselves, met the 3 matrons with grim nods. Manon fell into step behind her grandmother, one eye on the men, the other on their surroundings. The other 2 heirs did the same. At least they agreed on that. As heirs, their foremost duty was to protect their high witches, even if it meant sacrificing themselves. Manon glanced at the Yellowlegs matron, who held herself just as proudly as the 2 ancients as they walked into the shadows of the mountain. But Manon didn't take her hand off her blade, Windcleaver, for a heartbeat. The screams and wing beats and clank of metal were far louder here.
"This is where we breed and train 'em until they can make the crossing to the Omega,"
one of the men was saying, gesturing to the many cave mouths they passed as they strode through the cavernous hall.
"Hatcheries are in the belly of the mountain, a level above the forges for the armory. To keep the eggs warm, you see. Dens are a level above that. We keep 'em separated by gender and type. The bulls we hold in their own pens unless we want to breed 'em. They kill anyone in their cages. Learned that the hard way."
The men chuckled, but the witches did not. He went on about the different types. The bulls were the best, but a female could be just as fierce and twice as smart. The smaller ones were good for stealth and had been bred to be totally black against the night sky, or a pale blue to blend into daylight patrols. The average wyvern's colors they didn't care about so much, since they wanted their enemies to drop dead from terror, the man claimed. They descended steps carved into the stone itself, and if the reek of blood and waste didn't overwhelm every sense, then the din of the wyverns, a roaring and screeching and booming of wings and flesh on rock, nearly drowned out the man's words. But Manon stayed focused on her grandmother's position, on the positions of the others around her. And she knew that Asterin, 1 step behind her, was doing the same for her. He led them onto a viewing platform in a massive cavern. The sunken floor was at least 40 feet below. One end of the chamber wholly open to the cliff face, the other sealed with an iron grate. No, a door.
"This is one of the training pits,"
the man explained.
"It's easy to sort out the natural-born killers, but we discover a lot of them show their mettle in the pits. Before you... ladies," he said, trying to hide his wince at the word,
"even lay eyes on them, they'll be in here fighting it out."
"And when," said Mother Blackbeak, pinning him with a stare, "will we select our mounts?"
The man swallowed.
"We train a brood of gentler ones to teach you the basics."
A growl from Iskra. Manon might also have snarled at the implied insult, but the blue blood matron spoke. "You don't learn to ride by hopping on a war horse, do you?" The man almost sagged with relief.
"Once you're comfortable with the flying..."
"We were born on the back of the wind," said one of the coven leaders in the back. Some grunts of approval. Manon kept silent, as did her Blackbeak coven leaders. Obedience, discipline, brutality. They did not descend to boasting. The man fidgeted and kept his focus on Cressida, as if she were the only safe one in the room, even with her barbed crown of stars.
Idiot.
Manon sometimes thought the blue bloods were the deadliest of them all.
"Soon as you're ready," he said, "we can begin the selection process. Get you on your mounts and start the training."
Manon risked taking her eyes off her grandmother to study the pit. There were giant chains anchored in one of the walls, and enormous splotches of dark blood stained the stones, as if one of these beasts had been pushed against it. A giant crack spiderwebbed from the center. Whatever hit the wall had been tossed hard.
"What are the chains for?" Manon found herself asking.
Her grandmother gave her a warning look, but Manon focused on the man. Predictably, his eyes widened at her beauty, then stayed wide as he beheld the death lurking beneath it.
"Chains are for the bait beasts," he said. "They're the wyverns we use to show the others how to fight, to turn their aggression into a weapon. We're under orders not to put any of them down, even the runts and broken ones, so we put the weaklings to good use."
Just like dog fighting. She looked again to the splotch and the crack in the wall. The bait beast had probably been thrown by one of the bigger ones. And if the wyverns could hurl each other like that, then the damage to humans. Her chest tightened with anticipation, especially as the man said,
"Wanna see a bull?"
A glimmer of iron nails as Cressida made an elegant gesture to continue. The man let out a sharp whistle. None of them spoke as chains rattled, a whip cracked, and the iron gate to the pit groaned as it lifted. And then, heralded by men with whips and spears, the wyvern appeared. A collective intake of breath, even from Manon.
"Titus is one of our best,"
the man said, pride gleaming in his voice. Manon couldn't tear her eyes away from the gorgeous beast, his mottled gray body covered in a leathery hide, his massive back legs armed with talons as big as her forearm, and his enormous wings, tipped with a claw and used to propel him forward like a front set of limbs. The triangular head swiveled this way and that, and his dripping maw revealed yellow, curved fangs.
"Tails armed with a venomous barb,"
the man said, as the wyvern emerged fully from the pit, snarling at the men down there with him. The reverberations of the snarl echoed through the stone, into her boots and up her legs, right into her husk of a heart. A chain was clamped around his back leg, undoubtedly to keep him from flying out of the pit, The tail, as long as his body and tipped with two curved spikes, flicked back and forth like a cat's.
They can fly hundreds of miles in a day and still be ready to fight when they arrive,
the man said. And the witches all hissed in a breath. That sort of speed and endurance.
What do they eat?
Asked Petra, freckled face still calm and grave.
The man rubbed his neck. They'll eat anything, but they like it fresh.
So do we, said Iskra with a grin. Had anyone but the Yellowlegs heir said it, Manon would have joined in with the other grins around her.
Titus gave a sudden thrash, lunging for the nearest man while using his magnificent tail to snap the raised spears behind him. A whip cracked, but it was too late. Blood and screams and the crunch of bone. The man's legs and head tumbled to the ground. The torso was swallowed down in one bite. The smell of blood filled the air, and every single one of the Iron Teeth witches inhaled deeply. The man in front of them took a too casual step away. The bull in the pit was now looking up at them, tail still slashing against the floor.
Magic was gone, and yet this was possible,
this creation of magnificent beasts. Magic was gone, and yet Manon felt the sureness of the moment settle along her bones. She was meant to be here. She'd have Titus or no other, because she'd suffer no creature to be her mount but the fiercest, the one whose blackness called to her own. As her eyes met with the endless dark of Titus's, she smiled at the wyvern. She could have sworn he smiled back.
Chapter 13. Selena didn't realize how exhausted she was until all sounds, Emrys's soft singing from the table, the thud of dough as he kneaded it, the chopping of Luca's knife and his ceaseless chatter about everything and anything, stopped. And she knew what she'd find when she turned toward the stairwell. Her hands were pruny, fingers aching, back and neck throbbing, but Rowan was leaning against the archway of the stairwell, arms crossed and violence beckoning in his lifeless eyes.
Let's go.
Though his features remained cold, she had the distinct impression that he was somewhat annoyed at her for not sulking in a corner, bemoaning the state of her nails. As she left, Luca drew a finger across his neck as he mouthed, "Good luck." Rowan led her through a small courtyard, where sentries tried to pretend they weren't watching their every move, and out into the forest. The ward magic woven between the ring of megaliths again nipped at her skin as they passed, and nausea washed through her. Without the constant heat of the kitchen, she was half frozen by the time they strode between the moss-coated trees. But even that was only a vague flicker of feeling. Rowan trekked up a rocky ridge toward the highest reaches of the forest, still clouded in mist. She barely paused to take in the view of the foothills below, the plains before them, all green and fresh and safe from Otterlin. Rowan didn't utter a single word until they reached what looked like the weathered-stained ruins of a temple. It was now no more than a flatbed of stone blocks and columns whose carvings had been dulled by wind and rain. To her left lay Wendlin, foothills and plains and peace. To her right arose the wall of the Cambrian Mountains, blocking any sight of the immortal lands beyond. Behind her, far down, she could make out the fortress snaking along the spine of the mountain. Rowan crossed the cracked stones, his silver hair battered by the crisp, damp wind. She kept her arms loose at her sides, more out of reflex than anything. He was armed to the teeth, his face a mask of unyielding brutality. She made herself give a little smile, her best attempt at a dutiful, eager expression.
Do your worst.
He looked her over from head to toe. The mist-damp shirt, now icy against her puckered skin. The equally stained and damp pants. The position of her feet.
Wipe that smarmy, lying smile off your face.
His voice was as dead as his eyes, but it had a razor-sharp bite behind it. She kept her smarmy, lying smile.
I don't know what you're talking about.
He stepped toward her, the canines coming out this time.
Here's your first lesson, girl. Cut the horseshit. I don't feel like dealing with it, and I'm probably the only one who doesn't give a damn about how angry and vicious and awful you are underneath.
I don't think you particularly want to see how angry and vicious and awful I am underneath.
Go ahead and be as nasty as you want, princess, because I've been 10 times as nasty, for 10 times longer than you've been alive.
She didn't let it out. No. Because he truly didn't understand a thing about what lurked under her skin and ran claws down her insides. But she stopped any attempt to control her features. Her lips pulled back from her teeth.
Better. Now shift.
She didn't bother to sound pleasant as she said, It's not something I can control.
If I wanted excuses, I'd ask for them. Shift.
She didn't know how. She had never mastered it as a child, and there certainly hadn't been any opportunities to learn in the past decade. I hope you brought snacks, because we're going to be here a long, long while if today's lesson is dependent upon my shifting.
You're really going to make me enjoy training you.
She had a feeling he could have switched out training you for eating you alive. I've already participated in 12 versions of the master-disciple training saga, so why don't we cut that horseshit, too? His smile turned quieter, more lethal.
Shut your smart-ass mouth and shift.
A shuddering rush went through her, a spear of lightning in the abyss.
No.
And then he attacked. She'd contemplated his blows all morning, the way he'd moved, the swiftness and angles. So she dodged the first blow, sidestepping his fist, strands of her hair snapping in the wind. She even twisted far enough in the other direction to avoid the second strike. But he was so damn fast she could barely register the movements. So fast that she had no chance of dodging or blocking or anticipating the third blow. Not to her face, but to her legs, just as he had the night before. One sweep of his foot, and she was falling, twisting to catch herself, but not fast enough to avoid thudding her brow against a weather-smooth rock. She rolled, the gray sky looming, and tried to remember how to breathe as the impact echoed through her skull. Rowan pounced with fluid ease, his powerful thighs digging into her ribs as he straddled her. Breathless, head reeling, and muscles drained from a morning in the kitchen and weeks of hardly eating, she couldn't twist and toss him, couldn't do anything. She was outweighed, outmuscled, and for the first time in her life, she realized she was utterly outmatched.
Shift,
he hissed. She laughed up at him, a dead, wretched sound even to her own ears. Nice try. Gods, her head throbbed. A warm trickle of blood was leaking from the right side of her brow, and he was now sitting on her chest. She laughed again, strangled by his weight. You think you can trick me into shifting by pissing me off? He snarled, his face speckled with the stars floating in her vision. Every blink shot daggers of pain through her. It would probably be the worst black eye of her life. Here's an idea. I'm rich as hell, she said over the pounding in her head. How about we pretend to do this training for a week or so, and then you tell Maeve I'm good and ready to enter her territory, and I'll give you all the goddamned gold you want. He brought his canines so close to her neck that one movement would have him ripping out her throat.
Here's an idea, he growled. I don't know what the hell you've been doing for 10 years, other than flouncing around and calling yourself an assassin. But I think you're used to getting your way. I think you have no control over yourself. No control and no discipline. Not the kind that counts deep down. You are a child and a spoiled one at that. And, he said, those green eyes holding nothing but distaste, you are a coward.
Had her arms not been pinned, she would have clawed his face off right then. She struggled, trying every technique she'd ever learned to dislodge him, but he didn't move an inch. A low, nasty laugh.
Don't like that word.
He leaned closer still, that tattoo of his swimming in her muddled vision.
Coward. You're a coward who has run for 10 years while innocent people were burned and butchered and...
She stopped hearing him. She just stopped. It was like being underwater again, like charging into Nehemia's room and finding that beautiful body mutilated on the bed. Like seeing Galen Ashriver, beloved and brave, riding off into the sunset to the cheers of his people. She lay still, watching the churning clouds above, waiting for him to finish the words she couldn't hear, waiting for a blow she was fairly certain she wouldn't feel.
Get up,
he said suddenly,
and the world was bright and wide as he stood. Get up.
Get up. Kaol had said that to her once, when pain and fear and grief had shoved her over an edge. But the edge she'd gone over the night Nehemia had died, the night she'd gutted Archer, the day she'd told Kaol the horrible truth. Kaol had helped shove her over that edge. She was still on the fall down. There was no getting up, because there was no bottom. Powerful, rough hands under her shoulders, the world tilting and spinning, then that tattooed, snarling face in hers. Let him take her head between those massive hands and snap her neck. Pathetic, he spat, releasing her. Spineless and pathetic. For Nehemia, she had to try. Had to try. But when she reached in, toward the place in her chest where that monster dwelled, she found only cobwebs and ashes. Selena's head was still reeling, and dried blood now itched down the side of her face. She didn't bother to wipe it off, or to really care about the black eye that she was positive had blossomed during the miles they'd hiked from the temple ruins and into the forested foothills. But not back to Mistward. She was swaying on her feet when Rowan drew a sword and a dagger and stopped at the edge of a grassy plateau, speckled with small hills. Not hills. Barrows, the ancient tombs of lords and princes long dead, rolling to the other edge of trees. There were dozens, each marked with a stone threshold and sealed iron door. And through the murky vision, the pounding headache, the hair on the back of her neck rose. The grassy mounds seemed to breathe, to sleep. Iron doors, to keep the whites inside, locked with the treasure they'd stolen. They infiltrated the barrows and lurked there for eons, feeding on whatever unwitting fools dared seek the gold within. Rowan inclined his head toward the barrows.
I had planned to wait until you had some handle on your power. Planned to make you come at night, when the Barrow-wights are really something to behold. But consider this a favor, as there are few that will dare come out in the day. Walk through the mounds. Face the wights and make it to the other side of the field, Aelin. And we can go to Doranel whenever you wish.
It was a trap. She knew that well enough. He had the gift of endless time and could play games that lasted centuries. Her impatience, her mortality, the fact that every heartbeat brought her closer to death, was being used against her. To face the wights.
Rowan's weapons gleamed, close enough to grab. He shrugged those powerful shoulders as he said,
"You can either wait to earn back your steel, or you can enter as you are now."
The flash of temper snapped her out of it long enough to say, "My bare hands are weapon enough." He just gave a taunting grin and sauntered into the maze of hills. She trailed him closely, following him around each mound, knowing that if she fell too far behind, he'd leave her out of spite. Steady breathing and the yawns of awakening things arose beyond those iron doors. They were unadorned, bolted into the stone lintels with spikes and nails that were so old they probably predated Wendlin itself. Her footsteps crunched in the grass. Even the birds and insects did not utter a too loud sound here. The hills parted to reveal an inner circle of dead grass around the most crumbling barrow of all. Where the others were rounded, this one looked as if some ancient god had stepped on it. Its flattened top had been overrun with the gnarled roots of bushes. The three massive stones of the threshold were beaten, stained, and askew. The iron door was gone. There was only blackness within. Ageless, breathing blackness. Her heartbeat pounded in her ears as the darkness reached for her.
"I leave you here," Rowan said.
He hadn't set one foot inside the circle, his boots just an inch shy of the dead grass. His smile turned feral.
"I'll meet you on the other side of the field."
He expected her to bolt like a hare. And she wanted to. Gods, this place. That damned barrow only 100 yards away made her want to run and run and not stop until she found a place where the sun shone day and night. But if she did this, then she could go to Doranel tomorrow. And those wights waiting in the other half of the field. They couldn't be worse than what she'd already seen, and fought, and found dwelling in the world and inside of herself. So she inclined her head to Rowan, and walked onto the dead field. Chapter 14. Each step toward the central mound had Selena's blood roaring. The darkness between the stained ancient stones grew, swirling. It was colder, too, cold and dry. She wouldn't stop, not with Rowan still watching, not when she had so much to do. She didn't dare look too long toward the open doorway and the thing lurking beyond. A lingering shred of pride, stupid mortal pride, kept her from bolting through the rest of the field. Running, she remembered, only attracted some predators. So she kept her steps slow and called on every bit of training she'd had, even as the white slunk closer to the threshold, no more than a ripple of ravenous hunger encased in rags. Yet the white remained within its mound, even as she came near enough to drag into the barrow, as if it were hesitating. She was just passing the barrow when a pulsing, stale bit of air pushed against her ears. Maybe running was a good idea. If magic was the only weapon against wights, then her hands would be useless.
still.
The white lingered beyond the threshold. The strange, dead air pushed against her ears again, a high-pitched ringing wending itself into her head. She hurried, grass crunching as she gathered every detail she could to wield against whatever assailant lurked nearby. Treetops swayed in the misty breeze on the other end of the field. It wasn't far. Selena passed the central mound, cracking her jaw against the ringing in her ears. Worse and worse with each step. Even the white cringed away. It hadn't been hesitating because of her, or Rowan. The circle of dead grass ended a few steps away. Just a few. Just a few, and then she could run from whatever it was that could make a white tremble in fear. And then she saw him. The man standing behind the barrow. Not a white. She glimpsed only a flash of pale skin, night-dark hair, unfathomable beauty, and an onyx torque around his strong column of a neck. And blackness, a wave of it slamming down on her. Not oblivion, but actual dark, as if he'd thrown a blanket over the two of them. The ground felt grassy, but she couldn't see it. Couldn't see anything. Not beyond, not to the side, not behind. There was only her and the swirling black. Selena crouched, biting down on a curse as she scanned the dark. Whatever he was, despite his shape, he wasn't mortal. In his perfection, in those depthless eyes, there was nothing human. Blood tickled her upper lip. A nosebleed. The pounding in her ears began to drown out her thoughts. Any plan, as if her body were repulsed by the very essence of whatever this thing was. The darkness remained. Impenetrable. Unending. Stop. Breathe. But someone was breathing behind her. Was it the man? Or something else? The breathing was louder, closer, and a chill air brushed her nose, her lips, licking along her skin. Running, running was smarter than just waiting. She took several bounding steps that should have taken her toward the edge of the field, but nothing. Only endless black and the breathing thing that was closer now, reeking of dust and carrion and another scent. Something she hadn't smelled for a lifetime, but could never forget. Not when it had been coating that room like paint. Oh, gods. Breath on her neck, snaking up the shell of her ear. She whirled, drawing in what might very well be her last breath, and the world flashed bright. Not with clouds and dead grass, not with a fey prince waiting nearby. The room. This room. The servant woman was screaming. Screaming like a tea kettle. There were still puddles just inside the shut windows. Windows Selena herself had sealed the night before, when they'd been flapping in the swift and sudden storm. She had thought the bed was wet because of the rain. She'd climbed in because the storm had made her hear such horrible things. Made her feel like there was something wrong. Like there was someone standing in the corner of her room. It was not rain soaking the bed in that elegantly rugged chamber at the country manor. It was not rain that had dried on her hands and skin and nightgown. And that smell. Not just blood, but something else. "This is not real," Selena said aloud, backing away from the bed on which she was standing like a ghost. "This is not real." But there were her parents, sprawled on the bed, their throats sliced ear to ear. There was her father, broad-shouldered and handsome, his skin already gray. There was her mother, her golden hair matted with blood, her face. Her face.
slaughtered like animals. The wounds were so vulgar, so gaping and deep, and her parents looked so... Selena vomited. She fell to her knees, her bladder loosening just before she vomited a second time.
"This is not real. This is not real," she gasped, as a wet warmth soaked her pants.
She couldn't breathe, couldn't breathe, couldn't... And then she was pushing to her feet, bolting away from that room, toward the wood-paneled walls, through them like a wraith herself, until... Another bedroom. Another body.
Nehemia.
Carved up, mutilated, violated and broken. The thing lurking behind her slid a hand over her waist, along her abdomen, pulling her back against its chest with a lover's gentleness. Panic surged, so strong that she slammed her elbow back and up, hitting what felt like flesh and bone. It hissed, releasing her. That was all she needed. She ran, treading through the illusion of her friend's blood and organs, and then... Watery sunlight, and dead grass, and a heavily armed silver-haired warrior whom she sprinted toward, not caring about the vomit on her clothes, her soiled pants, the gasping, shrieking noise coming out of her throat. She ran until she reached him, and fell to the green grass, gripping it, shredding it, retching even though she had nothing left in her but a trickle of bile. She was screaming or sobbing or not making any sound at all. Then she felt the shift and the surge. A well opening beneath her stomach and filling with burning, relentless fire.
No. No!
Agony cleaved her in a pulse, her vision jumping between crystal clarity and the muted eyesight of mortals, her teeth aching as the fangs punched out and retracted, ebb and flow, immortal and mortal, mortal and immortal, shifting as fast as a hummingbird's flapping wings. With each shift, the well deepened, that wildfire rising and falling and reaching up, up. She really did scream then, because her throat burned. Or maybe that was the magic coming out, at last unleashed. Magic. Selena awoke under the canopy of the forest. It was still daylight, and from the dirt on her shirt and pants and boots, it seemed like Rowan had dragged her here from the barrows. That was vomit on her shirt and pants. And then there was... She'd wet herself. Her face heated, but she shoved away the thoughts about why she had pissed herself, why she had hurled her guts up. And that last thought, about magic.
No discipline, no control, and no courage, came a growling voice.
Head throbbing, she found Rowan sitting on a rock, his muscular arms braced on his knees. A dagger hung from his left hand, as if he'd been idly tossing the damn thing in the air while she lay in her own filth.
You failed, he said flatly. You made it to the other side of the field, but I said to face the whites, not throw a magical tantrum.
I will kill you, she said.
The words raw and gasping.
How dare...
That was not a white princess.
He flicked his attention toward the trees beyond her. She might have roared about using specifics to escape his bargain to bring her to Doranel. But when his eyes met hers again, he seemed to say,
That thing should not have been there.
Then what in hell was it, you stupid bastard? She silently shot back. He clenched his jaw before he said aloud,
I don't know. We've had skinwalkers on the prowl for weeks, roaming down from the hills to search for human pelts. But this was something different. I have never encountered its like, not in these lands or any other. Thanks to having to drag you away, I don't think I'll learn any time soon.
He gave her a pointed look at her current state.
It was gone when I circled back. Tell me what happened. I saw only darkness, and when you emerged, you were different.
She dared to look at herself again. Her skin was bone white, as if the little color she'd received lying on those rooftops in Verez had been leached away, and not only by fright and sickness.
No,
she said.
And you can go to hell. Other lives might depend on it.
I want to go back to the fortress, she breathed.
She didn't want to know about the creatures or about the skinwalkers or about any of it. Each word was an effort.
Right. Now.
You're done when I say you're done.
You can kill me or torture me or throw me off a cliff, but I am done for today. In that darkness, I saw things that no one should be able to see. It dragged me through my memories, and not the decent ones. Is that enough for you?
He spat out a noise, but got to his feet and began walking. She staggered and stumbled, knees trembling, and kept moving after him, all the way into the halls of Mistward, where she angled her body so that none of the passing sentries or workers could see her soiled pants, the vomit. There was no hiding her face, though. She kept her attention on the prince, until he opened a wooden door and a wall of steam hit her.
These are the female baths. Your room is a level up. Be in the kitchens at dawn tomorrow.
And then he left her again. Selena trudged into the steamy chamber, not caring who was in there as she shucked off her clothes, collapsed into one of the sunken stone tubs, and did not stir for a long, long while. Chapter 15. Kaol wasn't at all surprised that his father was 20 minutes late to their meeting. Nor was he surprised when his father strode into Kaol's office, slid into the chair opposite his desk, and offered no explanation for his tardiness. With calculated cool and distaste, he surveyed the office. No windows, a worn rug, an open trunk of discarded weapons that Kaol had never found the time to polish or send for repairs. At least it was organized. The few papers on his desk were stacked. His glass pens were in their proper holders. His suit of armor, which he rarely had occasion to wear, gleamed from its dummy in the corner. His father said at last,
"This is what our illustrious king gives the captain of his guard."
Kaol shrugged, and his father studied the heavy oak desk, a desk he'd inherited from his predecessor, and one on which he and Selena had. He shut down the memory before it could boil his blood, and instead smiled at his father.
"There was a larger office available in the glass edition, but I wanted to be accessible to my men."
It was the truth. He also hadn't wanted to be anywhere near the administrative wing of the castle, sharing a hallway with courtiers and councilmen.
"A wise decision."
His father leaned back in the ancient wooden chair.
"A leader's instincts."
Kaol pinned him with a long stare.
"I'm to return to Aniel with you. I'm surprised you waste your breath on flattery." "Is that so? From what I've seen, you have been making no move to prepare for this so-called return. You're not even looking for a replacement. Despite your low opinion of my position, it's one I take seriously. I won't have just anyone looking after this palace."
"You haven't even told His Majesty that you're leaving."
That pleasant, dead smile remained on his father's face.
"When I begged for my leave next week,
the king made no mention of you accompanying me.
Rather than land you in hot water, boy, I held my tongue."
Kaol kept his face bland. Neutral.